in Studdock. Are you married?
Yes.
Does your husband know you have come to us?
No.
And your age, if you please?
23.
And now, said Miss Ironwood, what have you to tell me? Jane took a deep breath.
I've been having bad dreams and feeling depressed lately, she said.
What were the dreams? Asked Miss Ironwood. Jane's narrative, she did not do it very well, took some time. While she was speaking, she kept her eyes fixed on Miss Ironwood's large hands and her black skirt and the pencil and the notebook. And that was why she suddenly stopped. For as she proceeded, she saw Miss Ironwood's hands cease to write and the fingers wrap themselves round the pencil. Immensely strong fingers, they seemed. And every moment they tightened, till the knuckles grew white and the veins stood out on the backs of the hands, and at last, as if under the influence of some stifled emotion, they broke the pencil in two. It was then that Jane stopped in astonishment and looked up at Miss Ironwood's face. The wide grey eyes were still looking at her with no change of expression.
"Pray continue, young lady," said Miss Ironwood.
Jane resumed her story. When she had finished, Miss Ironwood put a number of questions. After that she became silent for so long that Jane said,
"Is there, do you think, anything very seriously wrong with me?"
"There is nothing wrong with you," said Miss Ironwood.
"You mean it will go away?" "I have no means of telling. I should say probably not."
Disappointment shadowed Jane's face.
"Then can't anything be done about it? They were horrible dreams, horribly vivid, not like dreams at all."
"I can quite understand that."
"Is it something that can't be cured?"
"The reason you cannot be cured is that you are not ill."
"But there must be something wrong. It's surely not natural to have dreams like that."
There was a pause.
"I think," said Miss Ironwood, "I had better tell you the whole truth."
"Yes, do," said Jane in a strained voice. The other's words had frightened her.
"And I will begin by saying this," continued Miss Ironwood. "You are a more important person than you imagine."
Jane said nothing, but thought inwardly, "She is humouring me. She thinks I am mad."
"What was your maiden name?" asked Miss Ironwood.
"Tudor," said Jane. At any other moment she would have said it rather self-consciously, for she was very anxious not to be supposed vain of her ancient ancestry.
"The Warwickshire branch of the family?"
"Yes." "Did you ever read a little book, it is only 40 pages long, written by an ancestor of yours about the Battle of Worcester?"
"No. Father had a copy, the only copy, I think he said, but I never read it. It was lost when the house was broken up after his death."
"Your father was mistaken in thinking it the only copy. There are at least two others. One is in America, and the other is in this house."
"Well?" "Your ancestor gave a full and, on the whole, correct account of the battle, which he says he completed on the same day on which it was fought. But he was not at it. He was in York at the time."
Jane, who had not really been following this, looked at Miss Ironwood.
"If he was speaking the truth," said Miss Ironwood, "and we believe that he was, he dreamed it. Do you understand?"
"Dreamed about the battle?"
"Yes, but dreamed it right. He saw the real battle in his dream."
"I don't see the connection."
"Vision, the power of dreaming realities, is sometimes hereditary," said Miss Ironwood.
Something seemed to be interfering with Jane's breathing. She felt a sense of injury. This was just the sort of thing she hated, something out of the past, something irrational and utterly uncalled for, coming up from its den and interfering with her.
"Can it be proved?" she asked. "I mean, we have only his word for it."
"We have your dreams," said Miss Ironwood. Her voice, always grave, had become stern. A fantastic thought crossed Jane's mind. Could this old woman have some idea that one ought not to call even one's remote ancestors liars?
"My dreams?"
she said a little sharply.
"Yes," said Miss Ironwood.
"What do you mean?"
"My opinion is that you have seen real things in your dreams. You have seen Alcassan as he really sat in the condemned cell, and you have seen a visitor whom he really had."
"But, oh, this is ridiculous," said Jane.
That part was a mere coincidence. The rest was just a nightmare. It was all impossible. He screwed off his head, I tell you. And they dug up the horrible old man. They made him come to life. There are some confusions there, no doubt. But in my opinion, there are realities behind even those episodes. I am afraid I don't believe in that sort of thing, said Jane coldly. Your upbringing makes it natural that you should not, replied Miss Ironwood, unless, of course, you have discovered for yourself that you have a tendency to dream real things. Jane thought of the book on the table, which she had apparently remembered before she saw it. And then there was Miss Ironwood's own appearance, that too she had seen before she saw it. But it must be nonsense. Can you then do nothing for me? I can tell you the truth, said Miss Ironwood. I have tried to do so. I mean, can you not stop it, cure it? Vision is not a disease. But I don't want it, said Jane passionately. I must stop it. I hate this sort of thing. Miss Ironwood said nothing. Don't you even know anyone who could stop it? Said Jane. Can't you recommend anyone? If you go to an ordinary psychotherapist, said Miss Ironwood, he will proceed on the assumption that the dreams merely reflect your own subconscious. He would try to treat you. I do not know what would be the results of treatment based on that assumption. I am afraid they might be very serious, and it would certainly not remove the dreams. But what is all this about? Said Jane. I want to lead an ordinary life. I want to do my own work. It's unbearable. Why should I be selected for this horrible thing? The answer to that is known only to authorities much higher than myself. There was a short silence. Jane made a vague movement and said rather sulkily, Well, if you can do nothing for me, perhaps I'd better be going. Then suddenly she added, But how can you know all this? I mean, what realities are you talking about? I think, said Miss Ironwood, that you yourself have probably more reason to suspect the truth of your dreams than you have yet told me. If not, you soon will have. In the meantime, I will answer your question. We know your dreams to be partly true because they fit in with information we already possess. It was because he saw their importance that Dr. Dimble sent you to us. Do you mean he sent me here not to be cured but to give information? Said Jane. The idea fitted in with the things she had observed in his manner when she first told him.
Exactly.
I wish I had known that a little earlier, said Jane coldly, and now definitely getting up to go. I'm afraid it has been a misunderstanding. I had imagined Dr. Dimble was trying to help me.
He was. But he was also trying to do something more important at the same time.
I suppose I should be grateful for being considered at all, said Jane dryly. And how exactly was I to be helped by all this sort of thing? The attempt at icy irony collapsed as she said these last words, and red, undisguised anger rushed back into her face. In some ways she was very young.
Young lady, said Miss Ironwood, you do not at all realize the seriousness of this matter. The things you have seen concern something compared with which the happiness or even the life of you and me is of no importance. I must beg you to face the situation. You cannot get rid of your gift. You can try to suppress it, but you will fail, and you will be very badly frightened. On the other hand, you can put it at our disposal. If you do so, you will be much less frightened in the long run, and you will be helping to save the human race from a very great disaster. Or thirdly, you may tell someone else about it. If you do that, I warn you that you will almost certainly fall into the hands of other people who are at least as anxious as we to make use of your faculty, and who will care no more about your life and happiness than about those of a fly. The people you have seen in your dreams are real people. It is not at all unlikely that they know you have involuntarily been spying on them, and if so, they will not rest till they have got hold of you. I would advise you, even for your own sake, to join our side. You keep on talking of we and us. Are you some kind of company?
Yes, you may call it a company. Jane had been standing for the last few minutes, and she had almost been believing what she heard. Then, suddenly, all her repugnance came over her again, all her wounded vanity, her resentment of the meaningless complication in which she seemed to be caught, and her general dislike of the mysterious and the unfamiliar.
At that moment, nothing seemed to matter but to get out of that room and away from the grave, patient voice of Miss Ironwood. "She's made me worse already," thought Jane, still regarding herself as a patient. Aloud, she said, "I must go home now. I don't know what you are talking about. I don't want to have anything to do with it."
4.
Mark discovered in the end that he was expected to stay, at least for the night, and when he went up to dress for dinner, he was feeling more cheerful. This was partly due to a whisky and soda taken with Fairy Hardcastle immediately before, and partly to the fact that by a glance in the mirror he saw that he could not remove the objectionable piece of cotton wool from his lip. The bedroom, with its bright fire and its private bathroom attached, had also something to do with it. Thank goodness he had allowed Jane to talk him into buying that new dress suit. It looked very well laid out on the bed, and he saw now that the old one really would not have done. But what had reassured him most of all was his conversation with the fairy. It would be misleading to say that he liked her. She had indeed excited in him all the distaste which a young man feels at the proximity of something rankly, even insolently sexed, and at the same time wholly unattractive. And something in her cold eye had told him that she was well aware of this reaction, and found it amusing. She had told him a good many smoking-room stories. Often before now, Mark had shuddered at the clumsy efforts of the emancipated female to indulge in this kind of humour, but his shudders had always been consoled by a sense of superiority. This time he had the feeling that he was the butt. This woman was exasperating male prudery for her diversion. Later on, she drifted into police reminiscences. In spite of some initial scepticism, Mark was gradually horrified by her assumption that about 30% of our murder trials ended by the hanging of an innocent man. There were details, too, about the execution shed which had not occurred to him before. All this was disagreeable, but it was made up for by the deliciously esoteric character of the conversation. Several times that day he had been made to feel himself an outsider. That feeling completely disappeared while Miss Hardcastle was talking to him. He had the sense of getting in. Miss Hardcastle had apparently lived an exciting life. She had been, at different times, a suffragette, a pacifist, and a British fascist. She had been manhandled by the police and imprisoned. On the other hand, she had met prime ministers, dictators, and famous film stars. All her history was secret history. She knew from both ends what a police force could do and what it could not. And there were, in her opinion, very few things it could not do. "Especially now," she said. "Here in the Institute we're backing the crusade against red tape." Mark gathered that, for the fairy, the police side of the Institute was the really important side. It existed to relieve the ordinary executive of what might be called all sanitary cases, a category which ranged from vaccination to charges of unnatural vice, from which, as she pointed out, it was only a step to bringing in all cases of blackmail. As regards crime in general, they had already popularized in the press the idea that the Institute should be allowed to experiment pretty largely in the hope of discovering how far humane, remedial treatment could be substituted for the old notion of retributive or vindictive punishment. That was where a lot of legal red tape stood in their way. "But there are only two papers we don't control," said the fairy, "and we'll smash them. You've got to get the ordinary man into the state in which he says sadism automatically when he hears the word punishment. And then one would have carte blanche." Mark did not immediately follow this, but the fairy pointed out that what had hampered every English police force up to date was precisely the idea of deserved punishment. For desert was always finite. You could do so much to the criminal and no more. Remedial treatment, on the other hand, need have no fixed limit. It could go on till it had effected a cure, and those who were carrying it out would decide when that was. And if the cure were humane and desirable, how much more prevention? Soon anyone who had ever been in the hands of the police at all would come under the control of the NICE. In the end, every citizen. "And that's where you and I come in, sonny," added the fairy, tapping Mark's chest with her forefinger. "There's no distinction in the long run between police work and sociology. You and I've got to work hand in hand." This had brought Mark back to his doubts as to whether he were really being given a job, and, if so, what it was. The fairy had warned him that Steele was a dangerous man. "There are two people you want to be very cautious about," she said. "One is Frost, and the other is Old Wither." but she had laughed at his fears in general. "Oh, you're in all right, sonny," she said. "Only don't be too particular about what exactly you've got to do. You'll find out as it comes along. Wither doesn't like people who try to pin him down. There's no good saying you've come here to do this and you won't do that. The game's too fast just at present for that sort of thing. You've got to make yourself useful, and don't believe everything you're told." At dinner, Mark found himself seated next to Hengist. "Well," said Hengist, "have they finally roped you into it, eh?"
"I rather believe they have," said Mark.
"Because," said Hengist, "if you thought the better of it, I'm motoring back tonight and I could give you a lift."
"You haven't yet told me why you are leaving us yourself," said Mark.
"Ah, well, it all depends what a man likes. If you enjoy the society of that Italian eunuch and the mad parson and that Hardcastle girl, her grandmother would have boxed her ears if you were alive. Of course, there's nothing more to be said."
"Well, I suppose it's hardly to be judged on purely social grounds. I mean, it's something more than a club."
"Eh? Judged? Never judged anything in my life, to the best of my knowledge, except at a flower show. It's all a question of taste. I came here because I thought it had something to do with science. Now that I find it something more like a political conspiracy, I shall go home. I'm too old for that kind of thing, and if I wanted to join a conspiracy, this one wouldn't be my choice."
"You mean, I suppose, that the element of social planning doesn't appeal to you?"
"I can quite understand that it doesn't fit in with your work, as it does with sciences like sociology, but there are no sciences like sociology. And if I found chemistry beginning to fit in with a secret police run by a middle-aged virago who doesn't wear corsets and a scheme for taking away his farm and his shop and his children from every Englishman, I'd let chemistry go to the devil and take up gardening again."
"I think I do understand the sentiment that still attaches to the small man, but when you come to study the reality, as I have to do,
I should want to pull it to bits and put something else in its place. Of course, that's what happens when you study men. You find mare's nests. I happen to believe that you can't study men. You can only get to know them, which is quite a different thing. Because you study them, you want to make the lower orders govern the country and listen to classical music, which is balderdash. You also want to take away from them everything which makes life worth living, and not only from them, but from everyone except a parcel of prigs and professors."
"Bill," said Fairy Hardcastle suddenly from the far side of the table, in a voice so loud that even he could not ignore it. Hengist fixed his eyes upon her, and his face grew a dark red.
"Is it true," bawled the fairy, "that you're going off by car immediately after dinner?"
"Yes, Miss Hardcastle, it is."
"I was wondering if you could give me a lift."
"I should be happy to do so," said Hengist, in a voice not intended to deceive, "if we are going in the same direction."
"Where are you going?"
"I am going to Edgestow."
"Will you be passing Brenstock?"
"No. I leave the bypass at the crossroads just beyond Lord Holywood's front gate and go down what they used to call Potter's Lane."
"Oh, damn, no good to me. I may as well wait till the morning."
After this, Mark found himself engaged by his left-hand neighbour and did not see Bill the Blizzard again until he met him in the hall after dinner. He was in his overcoat and just ready to go to his car. He began talking as he opened the door, and thus Mark was drawn into accompanying him across the gravel sweep to where his car was parked.
"Take my advice, Studdock," he said, "or at least think it over. I don't believe in sociology myself, but you've got quite a decent career before you if you stay at Bracton. You'll do yourself no good by getting mixed up with the NICE, and, by God, you'll do nobody else any good either."
"I suppose there are two views about everything," said Mark.
"Eh? Two views? There are a dozen views about everything until you know the answer. Then there's never more than one. But it's no affair of mine. Good night."
"Good night, Hengist," said Mark. The other started up the car and drove off. There was a touch of frost in the air. The shoulder of Orion, though Mark did not know even that earnest constellation, flamed at him above the treetops. He felt a hesitation about going back into the house. It might mean further talk with interesting and influential people, but it might also mean feeling once more an outsider, hanging about and watching conversations which he could not join. Anyway, he was tired. Strolling along the front of the house, he came presently to another and smaller door by which, he judged, one could enter without passing through the hall or the public rooms. He did so, and went upstairs for the night immediately. 5.
Camilla Denniston showed Jane out, not by the little door in the wall at which she had come in, but by the main gate which opened on the same road about 100 yards further on. Yellow light from a westward gap in the grey sky was pouring a short-lived and chilly brightness over the whole landscape. Jane had been ashamed to show either temper or anxiety before Camilla. As a result, both had in reality been diminished when she said goodbye. But a settled distaste for what she called all this nonsense remained. She was not indeed sure that it was nonsense, but she had already resolved to treat it as if it were. She would not get mixed up in it, would not be drawn in. One had to live one's own life. To avoid entanglements and interferences had long been one of her first principles. Even when she had discovered that she was going to marry Mark if he asked her, the thought, "But I must still keep up my own life," had arisen at once, and had never, for more than a few minutes at a stretch, been absent from her mind. Some resentment against love itself, and therefore against Mark, for thus invading her life, remained. She was at least very vividly aware of how much a woman gives up in getting married. Mark seemed to her insufficiently aware of this. Though she did not formulate it, this fear of being invaded and entangled was the deepest ground of her determination not to have a child, or not for a long time yet. One had one's own life to live. Almost as soon as she got back to the flat, the telephone went.
"Is that you, Jane?" came a voice. "It's me, Margaret Dimble. Such a dreadful thing's happened. I'll tell you when I come. I'm too angry to speak at the moment. Have you a spare bed by any chance?" "What? Mr. Studdock's away?" "Oh, not a bit, if you don't mind. I've sent Cecil to sleep in college. You're sure it won't be a nuisance?" "Oh, thanks most awfully. I'll be round in half an hour."
Chapter 4. The Liquidation of Anachronisms. 1. Almost before Jane had finished putting clean sheets on Mark's bed, Mrs. Dimble, with a great many parcels, arrived.
"Oh, you're an angel to have me for the night," she said. "We've tried every hotel in Edgestow, I believe. The place is going to become unendurable. The same answer everywhere, all full up with the hangers-on and camp followers of this detestable NICE. Secretaries here, typists there, commissioners of works. The thing's outrageous. If Cecil hadn't had a room at college, I really believe he'd have had to sleep in the waiting room at the station. I only hope that man in college has aired the bed." "But what on earth's happened?" asked Jane. "Turned out, my dear."
"But it isn't possible, Mrs. Dimble. I mean, it can't be legal."
"Well, that's what Cecil said. Oh, just think of it, Jane. The first thing we saw when we poked our heads out of the back window this morning was a lorry on the drive with its back wheels in the middle of the rosebed, unloading a small army of what looked like criminals with picks and spades, right in our own garden. There was an odious little man in a peaked cap who talked to Cecil with a cigarette in his mouth. At least it wasn't in his mouth, but secateened onto his upper lip, you know. And guess what he said? He said they'd have no objection to our remaining in possession of the house, mind you, not the garden, till 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. No objection." "But surely, oh, surely it must be some mistake." "Of course. Cecil rang up your bursar. And, of course, your bursar was out. That took nearly all morning, ringing up again and again, and by that time the big beech that you used to be so fond of had been cut down, and all the plum trees. If I hadn't been so angry, I'd have sat down and cried my eyes out. That's what I felt like. At last Cecil did get on to your Mr. Busby, who was perfectly useless. Said there must be some misunderstanding, but it was out of his hands now, and we'd better get on to the NICE at Belbury. Of course it turned out to be quite impossible to get them, but by lunchtime we saw that one simply couldn't stay there for the night, whatever happened." "Why not?" "Oh, my dear, you've no conception what it was like. Great lorries and traction engines roaring past all the time, and a crane on a thing like a railway truck. Why, our own tradesmen couldn't get through it. The milk didn't arrive till 11 o'clock. The meat never arrived at all. They rang up in the afternoon to say their people hadn't been able to reach us by either road. We'd the greatest difficulty in getting into town ourselves. It took us half an hour from our house to the bridge. It was like a nightmare. Flares and noise everywhere, and the road practically ruined, and a sort of great tin camp already going up on the common. And the people! Such horrid men! I didn't know we had work people like that in England. Oh, horrible, horrible!"
Mrs. Dimble fanned herself with the hat she had just taken off.
"And what are you going to do?"
asked Jane.
"Heaven knows," said Mrs. Dimble. "For the moment we have shut up the house, and Cecil has been at Rumbold, the solicitor's, to see if we can at least have it sealed and left alone until we've got our things out of it. Rumbold doesn't seem to know where he is. He keeps on saying the NICE are in a very peculiar position legally. After that, I'm sure I don't know. As far as I can see, there won't be any houses in Edgestow. There's no question of trying to live on the far side of the river any longer, even if they'd let us. What did you say? Oh, indescribable. All the poplars are going down. All those nice little cottages by the church are going down. I found poor Ivy, that's your Mrs. Maggs, you know, in tears. Poor things, they do look dreadful when they cry on top of powder. She's being turned out, too. Poor little woman, she's had enough troubles in her life without this. I was glad to get away. The men were so horrible. Three big brutes came to the back door asking for hot water, and went on so they frightened Martha out of her wits, and Cecil had to go and speak to them. I thought they were going to strike Cecil, really I did. It was most horribly unpleasant. But a sort of special constable sent them away. What? Oh, yes, there are dozens of what look like policemen all over the place, and I didn't like the look of them either, swinging some kind of truncheon things, like what you'd see in an American film. Do you know, Jane, Cecil and I both thought the same thing. We thought, it's almost as if we'd lost the war. Oh, good girl, tea. That's just what I wanted.
You must stay here as long as you like, Mrs. Dimble, said Jane. Mark'll just have to sleep in college.
Well, really, said Mother Dimble, I feel at the moment that no fellow of Bracton ought to be allowed to sleep anywhere. But I'd make an exception in favour of Mr. Studdock. As a matter of fact, I shan't have to behave like the sword of Siegfried, and incidentally a nasty, fat, stodgy sword I should be. But that side of it is all fixed up. Cecil and I are to go out to the manor at St. Anne's. We have to be there so much at present, you see.
Oh, said Jane, involuntarily prolonging the exclamation as the whole of her own story flowed back on her mind.
Oh, why, what a selfish pig I've been, said Mother Dimble. Here have I been chattering away about my own troubles and quite forgetting that you've been out there and are full of things to tell me. Did you see Grace, and did you like her?
Is Grace Miss Ironwood? Asked Jane.
Yes. I saw her. I don't know if I liked her or not. But I don't want to talk about all that. I can't think about anything except this outrageous business of yours. It's you who are the real martyr, not me.
Oh, no, my dear, said Mrs. Dimble. I'm not a martyr. I'm only an angry old woman with sore feet and a splitting head, but that's beginning to be better, who's trying to talk herself into a good temper. After all, Cecil and I haven't lost our livelihood, as poor Ivy Maggs has. It doesn't really matter, leaving the old house. Do you know, the pleasure of living there was in a way a melancholy pleasure. I wonder, by the by, do humans really like being happy? A little melancholy, yes. All those big upper rooms which we thought we should want because we thought we were going to have lots of children, and then we never had. Perhaps I was getting too fond of mooning about them on long afternoons when Cecil was away. Pitying oneself. I should be better away from it, I dare say. I might have got like that frightful woman in Ibsen who was always maundering about dolls. It's really worse for Cecil. He did so love having all his pupils about the place. Jane, that's the third time you've yawned. You're dropping asleep, and I've talked your head off. Comes of being married 30 years. Husbands were made to be talked to. It helps them to concentrate their minds on what they're reading, like the sound of a weir. There, you're yawning again.
Jane found Mother Dimble an embarrassing person to share a room with because she said prayers. It was quite extraordinary, Jane thought, how this put one out. One didn't know where to look, and it was so difficult to talk naturally again for several minutes after Mrs. Dimble had risen from her knees. 2.
Are you awake now? Said Mrs. Dimble's voice quietly in the middle of the night.
Yes, said Jane. I'm sorry, did I wake you up? Was I shouting?
Yes. You were shouting out about someone being hit on the head.
I saw them killing a man. A man in a big car driving along a country road. Then he came to a crossroads and turned off to the right past some trees, and there was someone standing in the middle of the road waving a light to stop him. I couldn't hear what they said. I was too far away. They must have persuaded him to get out of the car somehow, and there he was talking to one of them. The light fell full on his face. He wasn't the same old man I saw in my other dream. He hadn't a beard, only a moustache. And he had a very quick, kind of proud way. He didn't like what the man said to him, and presently he put up his fists and knocked him down. Another man behind him tried to hit him on the head with something, but the old man was too quick and turned round in time. Then it was rather horrible, but rather fine. There were three of them at him, and he was fighting them all. I've read about that kind of thing in books, but I never realized how one would feel about it. Of course, they got him in the end.
They beat his head about terribly with the things in their hands. They were quite cool about it, and stooped down to examine him and make sure he was really dead. The light from the lantern seemed all funny. It looked as if it made long uprights of light, sort of rods, all round the place. But perhaps I was waking up by then. Oh, no, thanks, I'm all right. It was horrid, of course, but I'm not really frightened, not the way I would have been before. I'm more sorry for the old man. You feel you can go to sleep again? Oh, rather. Is your headache better, Mrs. Nimble? Oh, quite gone, thank you. Good night.
3. Without a doubt, thought Mark, this must be the mad parson that Bill the Blizzard was talking of. The committee at Belbury did not meet till 10:30, and ever since breakfast he had been walking with the Reverend Strake in the garden, despite the raw and misty weather of the morning. At the very moment when the man had first buttonholed him, the threadbare clothes and clumsy boots, the frayed clerical collar, the dark, lean, tragic face, gashed and ill-shaved and seamed, and the bitter sincerity of his manner had struck a discordant note. It was not a type Mark had expected to meet in the NICE. "Do not imagine," said Mr. Strake, "that I indulge in any dreams of carrying out our programme without violence. There will be resistance. They will gnaw their tongues and not repent. We are not to be deterred. We face these disorders with a firmness which will lead traducers to say we have desired them. Let them say so. In a sense we have. It is no part of our witness to preserve that organization of ordered sin which is called society. To that organization the message which we have to deliver is a message of absolute despair." "Oh, now that is what I meant," said Mark, "when I said that your point of view and mine must, in the long run, be incompatible. The preservation, which involves the thorough planning of society, is just precisely the end I have in view. I do not think there is or can be any other end. The problem is quite different for you, because you look forward to something else, something better than human society, in some other world." "With every thought and vibration of my heart, with every drop of my blood," said Mr. Strake, "I repudiate that damnable doctrine. That is precisely the subterfuge by which the world, the organization and body of death, has sidetracked and emasculated the teaching of Jesus, and turned into priestcraft and mysticism the plain demand of the Lord for righteousness and judgment here and now. The kingdom of God is to be realized here, in this world. And it will be. At the name of Jesus every knee shall bow. In that name I dissociate myself completely from all the organized religion that has yet been seen in the world." And at the name of Jesus, Mark, who would have lectured on abortion or perversion to an audience of young women without a qualm, felt himself so embarrassed that he knew his cheeks were slightly reddening. And he became so angry with himself and Mr. Strake at this discovery that they then proceeded to redden very much indeed. This was exactly the kind of conversation he could not endure. And never since the well-remembered misery of scripture lessons at school had he felt so uncomfortable. He muttered something about his ignorance of theology. "Theology," said Mr. Strake with profound contempt. "It's not theology I'm talking about, young man, but the Lord Jesus. Theology is talk, eyewash, a smokescreen, a game for rich men. It wasn't in the lecture room I found the Lord Jesus. It was in the coal pits and beside the coffin of my daughter. If they think that theology is a sort of cotton wool which will keep them safe in the great and terrible day, they'll find their mistake. For mark my words, this thing is going to happen. The kingdom is going to arrive, in this world, in this country. The powers of science are an instrument, an irresistible instrument, as all of us in the NICE know. And why are they an irresistible instrument?"
"Because science is based on observation," suggested Mark.
"They are an irresistible instrument," shouted Strake, "because they are an instrument in his hand, an instrument of judgment as well as of healing. That is what I couldn't get any of the churches to see. They are blinded, blinded by their filthy rags of humanism, their culture and humanitarianism and liberalism, as well as by their sins, or what they think their sins, though they are really the least sinful thing about them. That is why I have come to stand alone, a poor, weak, unworthy man, but the only prophet left. I knew that he was coming in power, and therefore where we see power, we see the sign of his coming. And that is why I find myself joining with communists and materialists and anyone else who is really ready to expedite the coming. The feeblest of these people here has the tragic sense of life, the ruthlessness, the total commitment, the readiness to sacrifice all merely human values, which I could not find amid all the nauseating cant of the organized religions.
You mean, do you, said Mark, that as far as immediate practice is concerned, there are no limits to your cooperation with the program?
Sweep away all idea of cooperation, said the other. Does clay cooperate with the potter? Did Cyrus cooperate with the Lord? These people will be used. I shall be used, too. Instruments, vehicles. But here comes the point that concerns you, young man. You have no choice whether you will be used or not. There is no turning back once you have set your hand to the plough. No one goes out of the NICE. Those who try to turn back will perish in the wilderness. But the question is, whether you are content to be one of the instruments which is thrown aside when it has served his turn, one which, having executed judgment on others, is reserved for judgment itself, or will you be among those who enter on the inheritance? For it's all true, you know. It is the saints who are going to inherit the earth, here in England, perhaps within the next 12 months. The saints and no one else. Know you not that we shall judge angels? Then suddenly lowering his voice, Drake added, The real resurrection is even now taking place, the real life everlasting. Here, in this world, you will see it.
I say, said Mark, it's nearly 20 past. Oughtn't we to be going to the committee?
Drake turned with him in silence.
Partly to avoid further conversation along the same lines, and partly because he really wanted to know the answer, Mark said presently, A rather annoying thing has happened. I've lost my wallet. There wasn't much money in it, only about 3 pounds. But there were letters and things, and it's a nuisance. Ought I to tell someone about it?
You could tell the steward, said Drake.
4. The committee sat for about 2 hours, and the deputy director was in the chair. His method of conducting business was slow and involved, and to Mark, with his Bracton experience to guide him, it soon became obvious that the real work of the NICE must go on somewhere else. This, indeed, was what he had expected, and he was too reasonable to suppose that he should find himself, at this early stage, in the inner ring, or whatever at Belbury corresponded to the progressive element at Bracton. But he hoped he would not be kept marking time on phantom committees for too long. This morning, the business mainly concerned the details of the work which had already begun at Edgestow. The NICE had apparently won some sort of victory which gave it the right to pull down the little Norman church at the corner. The usual objections were, of course, tabled, said Wither. Mark, who was not interested in architecture and who did not know the other side of the wind nearly so well as his wife, allowed his attention to wander. It was only at the end of the meeting that Wither opened a much more sensational subject. He believed that most of those present had already heard. Why do chairmen always begin that way, thought Mark, the very distressing piece of news which it was nevertheless his duty now to communicate to them in a semi-official manner. He was referring, of course, to the murder of William Hengist. As far as Mark could discover from the chairman's tortuous and elusive narrative, Bill the Blizzard had been discovered with his head beaten in by some blunt instrument lying near his car in Potter's Lane at about 4 o'clock that morning. He had been dead for several hours. Mr. Wither ventured to suppose that it would be a melancholy pleasure to the committee to know that the NICE police had been on the scene of the crime before 5, and that neither the local authorities nor Scotland Yard were making any objections to the fullest collaboration. He felt that if the occasion were more appropriate, he would have welcomed a motion for some expression of the gratitude they must all feel to Miss Hardcastle, and possibly of congratulations to her on the smooth interaction between her own forces and those of the state. This was a most gratifying feature in the sad story, and, he suggested, a good omen for the future. Some decently subdued applause went round the table at this. Mr. Wither then proceeded to speak at some length about the dead man. They had all much regretted Mr. Hengist's resolution to withdraw from the NICE, while fully appreciating his motives. They had all felt that this official severance would not in the least alter the cordial relations which existed between the deceased and almost all, he thought he could even say all, without exception, of his former colleagues in the Institute. The obituary, in Raleigh's fine phrase, was an instrument which the deputy director's talents well fitted him to play, and he spoke at great length. He concluded by suggesting that they should all stand in silence for 1 minute as a token of respect for the memory of William Hengist. And they did.
a world-without-end minute in which odd creakings and breathings became audible, and behind the mask of each glazed and tight-lipped face, shy, irrelevant thoughts of this and that came creeping out, as birds and mice creep out again in the clearing of a wood when the picnickers have gone. And everyone silently assured himself that he, at least, was not being morbid and not thinking about death. Then there was a stir and a bustle, and the committee broke up. 5. The whole process of getting up and doing the morning jobs was more cheerful, Jane found, because she had Mrs. Dimble with her. Mark often helped, but as he always took the view, and Jane could feel it, even if he did not express it in words, that anything would do, and that Jane made a lot of unnecessary work, and that men could keep house with a tithe of the fuss and trouble which women made about it. Mark's help was one of the commonest causes of quarrels between them. Mrs. Dimble, on the other hand, fell in with her ways. It was a bright, sunny morning, and as they sat down to breakfast in the kitchen, Jane was feeling bright herself. During the night, her mind had evolved a comfortable theory that the mere fact of having seen Miss Ironwood and had it all out would probably stop the dreams altogether. The episode would be closed. And now there was all the exciting possibility of Mark's new job to look forward to. She began to see pictures in her mind. Mrs. Dimble was anxious to know what had happened to Jane at St. Anne's and when she was going there again. Jane answered evasively on the first question, and Mrs. Dimble was too polite to press it. As to the second, Jane thought she wouldn't bother Miss Ironwood again, or wouldn't bother any further about the dreams. She said she had been silly, but felt sure she'd be all right now. And she glanced up at the clock and wondered why Mrs. Maggs hadn't yet turned up.
"Oh, my dear, I'm afraid you've lost Ivy Maggs," said Mrs. Dimble. "Didn't I tell you they'd taken her house too? I thought you'd understand she wouldn't be coming to you in future. You see, there's nowhere for her to live in Edgestow."
"Bother," said Jane, and added, without much interest in the reply, "What is she doing, do you know?"
"Well, she's gone out to St. Anne's."
"Well, has she got friends there?"
"Well, she's gone to the manor, along with Cecil and me."
"Do you mean she's got a job there?"
"Well, yes, I suppose it is a job."
Mrs. Dimble left at about 11. She also, it appeared, was going to St. Anne's, but was first to meet her husband and lunch with him at Northumberland. Jane walked down to the town with her to do a little shopping, and they parted at the bottom of Market Street. It was just after this that Jane met Mr. Curry. "Have you heard the news, Mrs. Studdock?" said Curry. His manner was always important and his tone always vaguely confidential, but this morning they seemed more so than usual.
"No. What's wrong?" said Jane.
She thought Mr. Curry a pompous fool, and Mark a fool for being impressed by him. But as soon as Curry began speaking, her face showed all the wonder and consternation he could have wished. Nor were they, this time, feigned. He told her that Mr. Hingist had been murdered sometime during the night, or in the small hours of that morning. The body had been found lying beside his car in Potter's Lane, badly beaten about the head. He had been driving from Belbury to Edgestow. Curry was at the moment hastening back to the college to talk to the warden about it. He had just been at the police station. One saw that the murder had already become Curry's property. The matter was, in some indefinable sense, in his hands, and he was heavy with responsibility. At another time Jane would have found this amusing. She escaped from him as soon as possible and went into Blackie's for a cup of coffee. She felt she must sit down. The death of Hingist in itself meant nothing to her. She had met him only once, and she had accepted from Mark the view that he was a disagreeable old man and rather a snob. But the certainty that she herself in her dream had witnessed a real murder shattered at one blow all the consoling pretences with which she had begun the morning. It came over her with sickening clarity that the affair of her dreams, far from being ended, was only beginning. The bright, narrow little life which she had proposed to live was being irremediably broken into. Windows into huge, dark landscapes were opening up on every side, and she was powerless to shut them. It would drive her mad, she thought, to face it alone. The other alternative was to go back to Miss Ironwood, but that seemed to be only a way of going deeper into all this darkness. This manor at St. Anne's, this kind of company, was mixed up in it. She didn't want to get drawn in. It was unfair. It wasn't as if she had asked much of life. All she wanted was to be left alone. And the thing was so preposterous. The sort of thing which, according to all the authorities she had hitherto accepted, could not really happen. 6. Kosser, the freckle-faced man with a little wisp of black moustache, approached Mark as he was coming away from the committee. "You and I have a job to do," he said. "Got to get out a report about Cure Hardy." Mark was very relieved to hear of a job, but he was a little on his dignity, not having liked Kosser much when he had met him yesterday, and he answered, "Does that mean I am to be in Steele's department after all?"
"That's right," said Kosser.
"The reason I ask," said Mark, "is that neither he nor you seemed particularly keen on having me. I don't want to push myself in, you know. I don't need to stay at the NICE at all, if it comes to that."
"Well, don't start talking about it here," said Kosser. "Come upstairs."
They were talking in the hall, and Mark noticed Wither pacing thoughtfully towards them. "Wouldn't it be as well to speak to him and get the whole thing thrashed out?" he suggested. But the deputy director, after coming within 10 feet of them, had turned in another direction. He was humming to himself under his breath, and seemed so deep in thought that Mark felt the moment unsuitable for an interview. Kosser, though he said nothing, apparently thought the same, and so Mark followed him up to an office on the third floor.
"It's about the village of Cure Hardy," said Kosser, when they were seated. "You see, all that land at Bragdon Wood is going to be little better than a swamp once they get to work. Why the hell we wanted to go there, I don't know. Anyway, the latest plan is to divert the Wynd. Block up the old channel through Edgestow altogether. Look, here's Shillingbridge, 10 miles north of the town. It's to be diverted there and brought down an artificial channel, here to the east, where the blue line is, and rejoin the old bed down here."
"Well, the university will hardly agree to that," said Mark. "What would Edgestow be without the river?"
"Oh, we've got the university by the short hairs," said Kosser. "You needn't worry about that. Anyway, it's not our job. The point is that the new Wynd must come right through Cure Hardy. Now, look at your contours. Cure Hardy is in the narrow little valley. Eh? Oh, you've been there, have you? Well, that makes it all the easier. I don't know these parts myself. Well, the idea is to dam the valley at the southern end and make a big reservoir. You'll need a new water supply for Edgestone now that it's to be the second city in the country.
But what happens to Cure Hardy?"
"Well, that's another advantage. We build a new model village. It's to be called Jules Hardy or Wither Hardy, 4 miles away, over here, on the railway."
"I say, you know, there'll be the devil of a stink about this. Cure Hardy is famous. It's a beauty spot. There are the 16th-century almshouses and a Norman church and all that."
"Well, exactly. That's where you and I come in. We've got to make a report on Cure Hardy. We'll run out and have a look round tomorrow, but we can write most of the report today. It ought to be pretty easy. If it's a beauty spot, you can bet it's insanitary. That's the first point to stress. Then we've got to get out some facts about the population. I think you'll find it consists almost entirely of the two most undesirable elements, small rentier and agricultural labourers."
"The small rentier is a bad element, I agree," said Mark. "I suppose the agricultural labourer is more controversial."
"The Institute doesn't approve of him. He's a very recalcitrant element in a planned community, and he's always backward. We're not going in for English agriculture. So you see, all we have to do is verify a few facts. Otherwise the report writes itself."
Mark was silent for a moment or two.
"Well, that's easy enough," he said. "But before I get down to it, I'd just like to be a bit clearer about my own position. Oughtn't I go and see Steele? I don't fancy settling down to work in this department if he doesn't want to have me."
"I wouldn't do that," said Kosser.
"Why not?"
"Well, for one thing, Steele can't prevent you if the DD backs you up, as he seems to be doing for the moment. For another, Steele is rather a dangerous man. If you just go quietly on with the job, he may get used to you in the end. But if you go and see him, it might lead to a bust-up. There's another thing, too."
Kosser paused, picked his nose thoughtfully, and proceeded, "Between ourselves, I don't think things can go on indefinitely in this department in the way they are at present."
The excellent training which Mark had had at Bracton enabled him to understand this. Kosser was hoping to get Steele out of the department altogether. He thought he saw the whole situation. Steele was dangerous while he lasted, but he might not last.
"I got the impression yesterday," said Mark, "that you and Steele hit it off together rather well."
"The great thing here," said Kosser, "is never to quarrel with anyone. I hate quarrels myself. I can get on with anybody, as long as the work gets done."
"Of course," said Mark.
"By the way, if we go to Cure Hardy tomorrow, I might as well run into Edgestow and spend the night at home."
For Mark, a good deal hung on the answer to this.
He might find out whether he were actually under orders from Kossa. If Kossa said, "You can't do that," he would at least know where he stood. If Kossa said that Mark couldn't be spared, that would be better still. Or Kossa might reply that he'd better consult the DD. That also would have made Mark feel surer of his position. But Kossa merely said, "Oh," leaving Mark in doubt whether no one needed leave of absence, or whether Mark was not sufficiently established as a member of the Institute for his absence to be of any consequence. Then they went to work on their report. It took them the rest of the day, so that Kossa and he came in to dinner late and without dressing. This gave Mark a most agreeable sensation, and he enjoyed the meal, too. Although he was among men he had not met before, he seemed to know everyone within the first 5 minutes and to be joining naturally in the conversation. He was learning how to talk their shop. "How nice it is," said Mark to himself next morning as the car left the main road at Duke's Eton and began descending the bumpy little lane into the long valley where Cure Hardy lay. Mark was not, as a rule, very sensitive to beauty, but Jane and his love for Jane had already awakened him a little in this respect. Perhaps the winter morning sunlight affected him all the more because he had never been taught to regard it as specially beautiful, and it therefore worked on his senses without interference. The earth and the sky had the look of things recently washed. The brown fields looked as if they would be good to eat, and those in grass set off the curves of the little hills as close-clipped hair sets off the body of a horse. The sky looked further away than usual, but also clearer, so that the long, slender streaks of cloud, dark slate colour against the pale blue, had edges as clear as if they were cut out of cardboard. Every little copse was black and bristling as a hairbrush, and when the car stopped in Cure Hardy itself, the silence that followed the turning off of the engine was filled with the noise of rooks that seemed to be calling, "Wake! Wake!"
"Bloody awful noise those birds make," said Kossa. "Got your map?"
"Now." He plunged at once into business.
They walked about that village for 2 hours and saw with their own eyes all the abuses and anachronisms they came to destroy. They saw the recalcitrant and backward labourer and heard his views on the weather. They met the wastefully supported pauper in the person of an old man shuffling across the courtyard of the almshouses to fill a kettle, and the elderly rentier, to make matters worse, she had a fat old dog with her, in earnest conversation with the postman. It made Mark feel as if he were on a holiday, for it was only on holidays that he had ever wandered about an English village. For that reason he felt pleasure in it. It did not quite escape him that the face of the backward labourer was rather more interesting than Kossa's, and his voice a great deal more pleasing to the ear. The resemblance between the elderly rentier and Aunt Gilly, when had he last thought of her? Good Lord, that took one back, did make him understand how it was possible to like that kind of person. All this did not in the least influence his sociological convictions. Even if he had been free from Bellbury and wholly unambitious, it could not have done so, for his education had had the curious effect of making things that he read and wrote more real to him than things he saw. Statistics about agricultural labourers were the substance. Any real ditcher, ploughman, or farmer's boy was the shadow. Though he had never noticed it himself, he had a great reluctance in his work ever to use such words as man or woman. He preferred to write about vocational groups, elements, classes, and populations. For, in his own way, he believed as firmly as any mystic in the superior reality of the things that are not seen. And yet, he could not help rather liking this village. When, at 1 o'clock, he persuaded Kossa to turn into the Two Bells, he even said so. They had both brought sandwiches with them, but Mark felt he would like a pint of beer. In the Two Bells it was very warm and dark, for the window was small. Two labourers, no doubt recalcitrant and backward, were sitting with earthenware mugs at their elbows, munching very thick sandwiches, and a third was standing up at the counter, conducting a conversation with the landlord.
"No beer for me, thanks," said Kossa, "and we don't want to muck about here too long. What were you saying?"
"I was saying that on a fine morning there is something rather attractive about a place like this, in spite of all its obvious absurdities."
"Yes, it is a fine morning. Makes a real difference to one's health, a bit of sunlight."
"I was thinking of the place."
"You mean this?"
said Kossa, glancing round the room.
"I should have thought it was just the sort of thing we wanted to get rid of. No sunlight, no ventilation. Haven't much use for alcohol myself. Read the Miller report. but if people have got to have their stimulants, I'd like to see them administered in a more hygienic way.
I don't know that the stimulant is quite the whole point, said Mark, looking at his beer. The whole scene was reminding him of drinks and talks long ago, of laughter and arguments in undergraduate days. Somehow one had made friends more easily then. He wondered what had become of all that set, of Carey and Wadston and Denniston, who had so nearly got his own fellowship.
"Don't know, I'm sure," said Cosser, in answer to his last remark. "Nutrition isn't my subject. You'd want to ask Stock about that."
"What I'm really thinking about," said Mark, "is not this pub, but the whole village. Of course, you're quite right, that sort of thing has to go, but it had its pleasant side. We'll have to be careful that whatever we're building up in its place will really be able to beat it on all levels, not merely in efficiency."
"Oh, architecture and all that," said Cosser. "Well, that's hardly my line, you know. That's more for someone like Wither. Have you nearly finished?"
All at once it came over Mark what a terrible bore this little man was, and in the same moment he felt utterly sick of the NICE. But he reminded himself that one could not expect to be in the interesting set at once. There would be better things later on. Anyway, he had not burnt his boats. Perhaps he would chuck up the whole thing and go back to Bracton in a day or two. But not at once. It would be only sensible to hang on for a bit and see how things shaped. On their way back, Cosser dropped him near Edgestow Station, and as he walked home, Mark began to think of what he would say to Jane about Bellbury. You will quite misunderstand him if you think he was consciously inventing a lie. Almost involuntarily, as the picture of himself entering the flat and of Jane's questioning face arose in his mind, there arose also the imagination of his own voice answering her, hitting off the salient features of Bellbury in amusing, confident phrases. This imaginary speech of his own gradually drove out of his mind the real experiences he had undergone. Those real experiences of misgivings and of uneasiness indeed quickened his desire to cut a good figure in the eyes of his wife. Almost without noticing it, he had decided not to mention the affair of Cure Hardy. Jane cared for old buildings and all that sort of thing. As a result, when Jane, who was at that moment drawing the curtains, heard the door opening and looked round and saw Mark, she saw a rather breezy and buoyant Mark. Yes, he was almost sure he'd got the job. The salary wasn't absolutely fixed, but he'd be going into that tomorrow. It was a very funny place. He'd explain all that later. But he had already got onto the real people there. Wither and Miss Hardcastle were the ones that mattered. "I must tell you about the Hardcastle woman," he said. "She's quite incredible." Jane had to decide what she would say to Mark much more quickly than he had decided what he would say to her. And she decided to tell him nothing about the dreams or St. Anne's. Men hated women who had things wrong with them, especially queer, unusual things. Her resolution was easily kept, for Mark, full of his own story, asked her no questions. She was not perhaps entirely convinced by what he said. There was a vagueness about all the details. Very early in the conversation she said in a sharp, frightened voice, she had no idea how he disliked that voice, "Mark, you haven't given up your fellowship at Bracton." He said no, of course not, and went on. She listened only with half her mind. She knew he often had rather grandiose ideas, and from something in his face she divined that during his absence he had been drinking much more than he usually did. And so, all evening, the male bird displayed his plumage, and the female played her part, and asked questions, and laughed, and feigned more interest than she felt. Both were young, and if neither loved very much, each was still anxious to be admired. 7. That evening the fellows of Bracton sat in common room over their wine and dessert. They had given up dressing for dinner as an economy during the war, and not yet resumed the practice, so that their sports coats and cardigans struck a somewhat discordant note against the dark Jacobean panels, the candlelight, and the silver of many different periods. Featherstone and Curry were sitting together. Until that night, for about 300 years, this common room had been one of the pleasant, quiet places of England. It was in Lady Alice, on the ground floor beneath the solar, and the windows at its eastern end looked out on the river and on Bragdon Wood, across a little terrace where the fellows were in the habit of taking their dessert on summer evenings. At this hour and season these windows were, of course, shut and curtained, and from beyond them came such noises as had never been heard in that room before,
shouts and curses and the sound of lorries heavily drumming past, or harshly changing gear, rattling of chains, drumming of mechanical drills, clanging of iron, whistles, thuddings, and an all-pervasive vibration. Saiva sonare verbera tum stridor ferri tractaeque catenae, as Glossop, sitting on the far side of the fire, had observed to Jewel. For beyond those windows, scarcely 30 yards away on the other side of the wind, the conversion of an ancient woodland into an inferno of mud and noise and steel and concrete was already going on apace. Several members even of the progressive element, those who had rooms on this side of the college, had already been grumbling about it. Curry himself had been a little surprised by the form which his dream had taken now that it was a reality, but he was doing his best to brazen it out, and though his conversation with Featherstone had to be conducted at the top of their voices, he made no allusion to this inconvenience. "It's quite definite, then," he bawled, "that young Studdock is not coming back." "No, quite," shouted Featherstone. "He sent me a message through a high official to tell me to let the college know." "When will he send a formal resignation?" "Well, haven't an earthly. Like all these youngsters, he's very casual about these things. As a matter of fact, the longer he delays, the better." "You mean it gives us a chance to look about us?" "Quite. You see, nothing need come before the college till he writes. One wants to have the whole question of his successor taped before that."